listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. On our live broadcast date is March 31st, 2017. This is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And spring is really here because the magnolia trees are blooming.
That is true, and let's just hope that we don't get a late frost.
No, don't even think
Don't even think that. No. So we are back in the saddle here.
Yeah.
And what do we have for our listeners today on Writers' Voices?
Well, actually, we have a very interesting book, and one that everyone should read, although I'm going to say it's difficult because it talks, the name of it's War Torn. You know, that War Torn, we've heard that phrase forever, but you don't really realize what it means until you read something like this, how a war tears up a country and tears up the people.
So War Torn is Stories of Courage, Love, and Resilience by Kenneth Miller. And tell us a little bit about Kenneth E. Miller.
Okay. Excuse me, I have this crud. He is an international expert on the impact of armed conflict on civilians. Psychologist Kenneth E. Miller has been working with war-affected communities since 1991 as a researcher, clinician, organizational consultant, and filmmaker. A professor of clinical and community psychology for much of his career, San Francisco State University, Pomona College. In 2015, he joined the Dutch NGO, War Child Holland, and is currently based in Amsterdam. His website is www.kennethmiller.com.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Ken.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, it's obvious that you work in a very important area, but I'm curious how you got involved in this to begin with.
Well, I guess if I had to trace a beginning, it was one of those moments. I guess we probably all have these in our lives looking back. You know, it seems like a very innocuous, simple decision that sets your whole life down a different path. I was a grad student at Michigan in clinical psychology, and I was thinking about dropping out of the program. I wasn't having a great time and wasn't really into my studies. And one night, it was in the middle of my second year, a couple came through town from Guatemala to talk about this really innovative mental health project they were doing in the highlands of Guatemala with Mayan Indians who had survived the genocide that was still kind of coming to an end. And I almost didn't go. I was really tired. I wasn't in a great mood. I kicked off my shoes at home and put on the TV. And then for some reason, something in my head told me that I should go to this talk. And I went. And it was love at first sight. Only it didn't involve a woman. It involved a kind of work that I didn't know existed. I fell in love with the project that they were describing. And I sat with them and talked with them late into the night, and by the end of the weekend, I'd agreed to go down and volunteer on their project in Guatemala and carve out a dissertation based on my work there. Well, they left town, and I immediately had a panic attack. I signed up to go to a war zone. I'd never been to one, and I didn't speak a word of Spanish. But it ended up being one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. And I ended up spending almost 2 years in Guatemala and then in refugee camps just across the border in Mexico, where a lot of Guatemalans had fled. And that set in motion everything I've done professionally and a lot of what's happened in my personal life, actually, all because I made a decision to go to an event rather than stay home and watch TV that night.
Wow.
Yeah, it's one of those moments.
The turning point.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think we all, I mean, it fascinates me that I think we all have those turning points, those moments that are based on a decision that at the time seems like rather trivial. And, you know, you end up deciding to go out to a party that you didn't feel like going to, and you meet your future spouse at that party. And so if you'd stayed in that, you would have lived a different life, not better or worse, but different. So, mm-hmm. So that's the kind of historical answer, I guess, to how I got into doing the work, and everything evolved out of that. And it has always felt like a wonderful fit, and one experience has led to another, to another, to another. And that's the beginning of it.
Ken, what are some of the other countries that you have worked in?
So after I returned from the refugee camps in Mexico, I directed a clinic for Bosnian refugees in Chicago for 2 years. And then I moved out to San Francisco. I decided that working in the confines of the clinic, it felt too limiting, too frustrating. We didn't have the freedom to kind of work in innovative ways. We were dependent on state funding, and we really had to just provide traditional clinical services. And the longer I stayed at the clinic, the more I saw that what refugees needed went way beyond the kind of narrow services of therapy and medication that we could provide. So I became a faculty member in San Francisco and began working with the Bosnian community there, and ended up meeting an Afghan woman who was a graduate student of mine and got deeply involved with community projects with Afghans who are resettled in the San Francisco area in quite large numbers. And through that connection, ended up doing a lot of work in Afghanistan itself. So there's Afghanistan, and after that, Iraq, Sri Lanka. I'm currently doing a fair amount of work in Lebanon with Syrian refugees. So it's a fairly extensive list. The one big gap in my international resume is Africa. Every time I've had a project in some part of Africa, for one reason or another, it's fallen through. So I'm woefully ignorant about a big part of the world where some of the worst armed conflicts have taken place.
Well, what are some of you said that the refugees needed things beyond their traditional kind of clinical therapy. What are some of the most effective things that you have found, the tools that you use to help refugees from war-torn areas?
Well, you know, back in, I want to say the old days, by which I mean about 15 years ago, the thinking was that the trauma and the depression that refugees struggled with was primarily because of whatever war they'd escaped from. And that makes intuitive sense. You know, when you think about refugees, you think about all these awful things we see in the media. But my own research and that of a number of colleagues has shown something quite different, and I think quite interesting, which is that the experiences that refugees have when they finally get to wherever they're heading actually have as big an impact on their mental health as whatever they went through in their country of origin. And the experience of living as a refugee can be extraordinarily stressful. But there are this host of what we call post-migration stressors related to the experience of living in exile that have an impact on mental health. I'll give you an example, a story from the clinic to try and bring this to life. We had there was a woman coming into the clinic seeing one of our student intern therapists, who is a wonderful therapist, and she was severely depressed and had some symptoms of trauma, memories that kept intruding, and some bad dreams from, she'd lived through the war in Bosnia, where, you know, Bosnian Serbs had entered her village and killed a lot of people and forced her to end up in a refugee camp and then Chicago. So understandably, you know, the treatment was very kind of war trauma focused, and she was on medication, but she wasn't getting better at all. She was just locked in this depression. Well, you know, Greg and I sat back and we looked at her situation. Why wasn't she getting better? And, well, her life, she'd come over with her grown son and his wife, and she lived alone, well, with them, but alone during the day because they both worked. And she didn't speak English, and she was terrified of leaving the house without speaking English or taking public transportation and getting lost in Chicago somewhere and not being able to find her way home. So we changed the therapy completely, and the therapy became Greg and this woman, the 60-year-old woman, getting on the bus and the L, the public, you know, the subway, and just intentionally getting lost together, and then learning together how to use the subway and the train map and the bus map, and gradually, within about 6 weeks, she knew how to get around town. And that allowed her to get to language classes, and it allowed her to go to social events, and it allowed her to visit people in their homes. And it was extraordinary. Within 2 months, her depression had lifted, the trauma symptoms dissipated, and she recovered. And this was not psychotherapy in any kind of conventional sense, and it was not medication. What happened was she became empowered to take control of her life again and then to connect socially and to have that social support. And that was really what helped her. And that got me thinking a lot about, you know, what is it that causes so much pain in refugee communities? And, the more research that Greg and I and others did, the more we began to find that it was the isolation and the lack of any sort of control or power, the loss of all the social roles that people played. You know, we see a real increase in family violence in refugee communities. And one of the big reasons for that is men feel terribly disempowered when they can't work and they can't provide for their families, and they feel humiliated, and they may encounter a lot of discrimination. So then I realized that in addition to trauma therapy, which of course is important, and in addition to medication to help people relax or sleep, we need to find ways to help people feel more empowered and get started in building new lives.
Wow.
It's even more complicated than you thought when you started out, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But it's, you know, the same patterns. You see them everywhere you go.
Well, people are people,
Well, go ahead, please.
People are people, and they have the same emotions no matter where they live. Some of these people have been through horrific things. We can't even imagine what they've been through. But still, they're still human beings, and they have the same emotions, the same reactions that we have. So you have to find out.
And I mean, that's right. And I think what's important, and this is one of the themes that runs through the book. You know, as much as I'm fascinated by cultural differences, and I do take the reader on a journey through each of the different cultures in the countries that I travel to, I'm fascinated by that. But one of the real themes of the book is that despite all those differences, I really do believe that we're more alike than we are different. So, you know, there was a wonderful story. There's a chapter. So the book is organized by each chapter is a different country.
Right.
With the exception of Bosnia, which is I take you into the therapy experiences of different clients in the Bosnian clinic in Chicago. But in the Sri Lanka chapter, I take the reader, we go into this village where I ended up making a documentary film. This is a village where one night during the civil war there, the village is right on the front line. And the Tamil Tigers, the armed militant group from the other side of the front line, crossed into this village and they killed 54 people during the night. And there were two girls, two best friends. They were both about 7 or 8 at the time, and both of them lost their fathers. And one of them, when I discovered this village, you know, 7 years later, well, for much of those 7 years, the village would empty out at night, and people were so terrified of another attack that they would leave the village at sunset, either sleep in the jungle or sleep in homes of family or friends farther away, and then come back at sunrise so the kids could get to school and the parents could work in the rice paddies. Well, these two girls, these best friends, both lost their dads that night. And the one is locked in pain 7 years later. She's still despondent and has not healed at all. And her mother can't tolerate her daughter's grief, can't tolerate her own grief. Her mother kept saying, sadness is for weak people. And by not allowing sadness, she sort of kept it alive in her daughter and herself. But the other girl, Samantha, who I write about in the book, she is a model of resilience and healing because she also lost her dad. But her mom and her siblings, they came together and provided support to each other. And her mother, you know, they engaged in traditional Buddhist rituals to honor the spirit of the dead and earn good, what they call merit, so that the dead person's spirit will never suffer again in a future life like they did in this life. And that's a very important ritual for them. But what I want to focus on is that this mother understood that grief is a normal human experience and that she needed to support her children through the grief and the loss of their father. And by creating a space for that grief, she allowed the children to move through it and come out the other end. And now Samanthi is this lovely young woman who loves to dance, takes joy in the dance troupe that she's part of. She has all kinds of dreams for the future. She's a passionate reader. She has a sense of aliveness that's remarkable and such a contrast to her friend. And there's a kind of a universal theme there about when we lose someone powerful to us, whether it's in the context of war or illness or old age, we grieve. And when we create space for the grief, we can heal. And, you know, when you ask Samanthi about her father, she tears up, she gets sad. But that's not depression, that's not psychopathology, that's just normal sadness. And it rises and it falls again. And that's something I've encountered everywhere I've gone, that when people have the support that they need and to move through the pain, they do move through the pain, and they heal, and they find their way back to life.
So that's what your role has been, is helping, is providing that support in whatever way is needed.
Well, in part, that's been my role. I've played a lot of different roles.
You know, yes. Like,
a lot of what I do is I work with local organizations to help them develop programs to provide the services. You know, the old saying, you know, teach someone to fish and they eat for a lifetime, but give them fish and they just eat for a day. I can go in and I can provide direct services, but what I'd rather do is build capacity of local organizations and help them provide the help, because they're the folks who know the cultural context and they're the ones who are going to stay. And so that tends to be more of my role. Now, in the Bosnian clinic, I and my colleagues, we provided the direct care. But when I work internationally, I'm much more interested in building local capacity of organizations.
Wonderful. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kenneth E. Miller, author of War Torn, Stories of Courage, Love, and Resilience. So, Kenneth, what made you decide to, you know, you've been doing this work for many years. What made you decide to write this book now?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I've been writing my experiences. I'm fascinated by stories, and I grew up in a family of readers, and I'm passionately captivated by good storytelling. And when I first started doing this work down in Guatemala and then in the refugee camps in Mexico, whenever I would hear a story that somehow captured something really powerful for me, I would write it down or talk it into a tape recorder. And the first story that really captured me and that I remember writing down was my girlfriend at the time and I, we were working in the refugee camps, and we had been adopted by this one Guatemalan family, this Mayan Indian family, and they'd been in this camp for about 5 years. And we were sitting around the fire with them one night, and Mateo, the father, decided to tell this story. I think I'd asked him to tell the story of how they decided to leave Guatemala. And he talked about how the army was going through the highlands in Guatemala, just razing villages, massacring thousands of people. And when they got to the neighboring village, there was only one person out of 370 who survived a day. It was a horrible day. And that person came to the village where Mateo and his family were living and told them what happened. And overnight, the village emptied out, and they all headed north into the mountains to escape. Well, on the road heading north to Mexico, there were seven kids, Mateo and his wife Maria. They were walking in the middle of the night through a cornfield, and they suddenly realized that they'd come upon a road that cut through the field, and that there was a large troop of soldiers marching near, you know, very close to where they were. And if the soldiers had come upon them, they would have killed the whole family immediately in the cornfield. So they're huddled in the dark in the night with a one-year-old baby in Maria's arms, and she has her hand gently over his mouth so he won't make a sound, praying that he won't sneeze or cry and give them away. And the soldiers passed, and they survived. And they survived that night and the weeks that followed and the months, and they made their way through the mountains and into Mexico, and where I met them. And I wrote that story down as Mateo sort of finished talking about it around the fire in the camp, because the image of this family huddled in the dark in the cornfield with the soldiers, you know, 20 feet away, captured for me the absolute fragility of life in a setting of war. But it also captured for me the power of love. You know, the love of Mateo and Maria for their family drove them to make this incredibly dangerous journey and drove them into safety, and they survived. So over the years, I've been writing stories like this, and I think I was in Afghanistan where we had just finished a very intensive research study of mental health in Kabul, and I was sitting around with my colleague Pat O'Midian, an anthropologist, and she shared a really powerful story that a workshop she'd just come back from, and I can tell that story in a bit, but I was so struck by the story that she told that I wrote it down, and then for some reason a light went on. Wait a minute, I've been writing these stories for years. There's something really powerful about these stories that are real and true and capture the experience of civilians affected by war. Everyday folks capture not only the violence and the sadness and the heartbreak, but also the extraordinary courage and love and resilience that you see. The particular story that Pat told was about, the head of our research team, a guy called Samad Khan, and he's a remarkable guy. He's a big bear of a man, looks like what you'd imagine a big freedom fighter or a jihadist would look like in Afghanistan, but he's a real peace-loving man. And one day, Samad Khan was driving his family up a steep mountain road during the war against the Soviets when they occupied Afghanistan. And they reached this manned checkpoint way up the mountains. And the Mujahideen, the freedom fighters, stopped Samad Khan, and they told him to get out of the truck and show his papers. And his sister and her family were in the back of the truck. And he got out of the truck, and in one of those, again, those horrible moments that change one's life forever, he realized he forgot to set the handbrake.
Oh!
So he watched in horror as the truck spiraled off the side of the mountain and crashed hundreds of feet below. So he had to go down and pick up the bodies of his sister and family and bring them all back to Kabul for burial. But actually, I talked to Samad Khan about this experience, and I said to him, how on earth did you survive the horror of that event? You'd think that that's the kind of experience that would just break somebody forever.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, yeah, you know, I mean, I fell into a pretty severe depression. They call it jigarkhun, in heartbreak in Afghanistan. And he had some symptoms of trauma. But he said that he dug deep into his faith, and he, in particular, a concept in Afghanistan they call sabr. And sabr means patience and a faith that in a plan that God understands, but we can't. And somehow that faith and that patience, which is also part of this concept of sabr, this patience, and the support of his extended family and friends, got him through it. And he became this wonderful, peace-loving community leader and community activist. I was so struck, not so much by the horror of the story, because I've heard horror stories like that throughout my career, but more by his recovery and resilience and the fact that instead of becoming angry and violent, he became deeply committed to peace. And he showed that healing really is possible with the support of love and friends. Anyway, that story was the one that, you know, I jotted it down and the light went off. And I thought, you know what, these stories are amazing. I want to share these. And I started looking for the themes that connected them, themes about resilience and the capacity to heal. And then what happens when we exceed that capacity, when people really do break? I don't think it happens often, but occasionally, you know, the horrors are too great and it's very difficult for people to come back.
I was going to ask you how you remember all these details. Did you You said you used a tape recorder, and you must have had a journal, daily journal, that you made notes in, because when you go to write a book like this, full of all these details, it's really amazing. So how did you do that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was, you know, when I decided to write the book, I that was my first thought. Well, how am I going to remember all these details? But I have kept journals, detailed journals, every place I've worked. And then once I got to Afghanistan, I started writing these detailed dispatches. And when I was in Sri Lanka and we made the documentary film, of course, I had the film and I had all the interview raw material that we'd done. And I've done research in lots, because in my life as an academic, as a professor in California, I've done lots of studies where some of them are, you know, questionnaire-based, but some of them are interview-based. So I have lots and lots of data, lots of stories to sift through. So there was way more than enough material to recreate accurately. And then, you know, there were times where I didn't remember details, but I'd contact people. I hadn't been in touch with for 15 or 20 years. And say, hey, I'm working on this book. I'm not sure if it happened this way or that way. What's your take on it? But then I also realized something. You know, what I realized is that, you know, you have an event, and if you want to get exactly what happened and you ask six people,
you're going to get six stories. Six,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You get six slightly different versions.
Yeah, six
and
variations.
You realize that, you know, there. Truth is a somewhat elusive thing, and I think when you're writing nonfiction, of course, you want to approximate the truth as closely as you can, but I also, at some point, had this liberating realization that just because somebody remembered something a bit differently than I remembered it, they didn't necessarily remember it more accurately. So I would always try and check, you know, against other people's memories, but I also learned to trust my own.
Isn't it interesting that even though we know that to be true, that we still, when we read something in a history book or in a newspaper or something, we assume that it's the absolute truth. And it's really only one person's interpretation of the truth, and it may be several people removed from what actually happened.
Well, you know, a great example of that, I was in the Gaza Strip recently for a project I'm working on, and while I was there, a splinter group in the Gaza Strip, a political kind of extreme group, shot an empty rocket into an Israeli village. It landed in, a yard, and it didn't have any explosive attached to it, but the Israelis responded by sending their planes over Gaza City, and they dropped, I think, 36 rockets, explosives, on the city. And I was in a hotel doing a training with a group of Gazans on this mental health project, and the hotel just shook with every explosion. And it was really interesting because I got scared. I was really shaken up. But all the Gazans just kept on going. They're like, they're used to it. And the kids outside through the window on the beach, they just kept playing. So first off, there's that difference in if you ask me to describe that experience and you ask the Gazans to describe it, we probably would have described it quite differently. But if you ask the Israelis and the Palestinians to describe what happened on that day, my guess is you would get two completely different narratives. One from the Israeli perspective about a Gazan, you know, military attack on Israel, and from the Palestinian perspective, you would have heard about a massive Israeli overreaction and, you know, extremely violent attack on Gaza City. So where does the truth lie? Well, you know, it depends who you're talking to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Kenneth, why don't you read something from War Torn for us? Share one of the stories from the book.
So what I'll read, this is a story called Frozen Grief. It takes place in Guatemala. So I'll just leave it at that for the moment. My colleague Martin was intense and animated. He was a great storyteller, always pausing just long enough at key moments to build the suspense, then finishing with an ending that left you laughing or in tears or simply bewildered by the crazy things that happened in this country. He came in one morning dressed in his usual jeans and button-down shirt, looking agitated. "Man," he said, You won't believe this one, Ken. Go on. He just heard about a woman, I'll call her Maria, maybe 50 years old, a Mayan Indian who lived in a small village near Lake Atitlan. The deepest lake in Central America, Atitlan is ringed by steep mountains that were thought to be home to armed guerrillas during the war. That made the villages surrounding the lake hot targets for the army, whose strategy was to terrorize the villagers into submission and destroy any real or potential support they might be inclined to offer the guerrillas. Maria's teenage son had disappeared during the height of the Army's Scorched Earth campaign. Soldiers took him away at gunpoint one night, along with several other young men from the community. Neither he nor any of the others abducted that night were ever seen or heard from again. That was 10 years ago, Martin said. He paused for a moment, collecting his thoughts, and then said, "The thing is, every week she cleans his room, dusts it, wipes it down, sweeps it, keeps everything just as it was the day he was taken away, just in case, you know, he comes back." 10 years, man, he continued, and she's still waiting for him to come home. "That's a long time," I said. "No way, that kid's still alive." "Right, no way," Martin paused for a moment. "Imagine that," he said. 10 years, and she's still waiting. I saw the sadness in his face. We both knew what Maria couldn't bear to admit. Her son was never coming back. He'd probably been dead for most of the past decade. It's a familiar story lived out by thousands of families. People didn't just disappear in Guatemala. They got disappeared. It's something you did to someone, a transitive verb. Él fue desaparecido, someone might say. He was disappeared. There's no corresponding verb for reappearing, because people rarely reappeared. Sure, sometimes the disappeared did show up again, usually as a corpse on the side of a road, bearing signs of torture. But there was no need to invent a word for that. Mostly, though, the disappeared remained that way. That left families in a terrible state. What Maria was going through, cleaning her son's room, holding on to hope, despite the almost certain reality that he was no longer alive, it's a familiar syndrome in Latin America. Argentines lived through it so often that psychoanalyst Maria Langer coined the term frozen grief to describe the syndrome she saw among families of the disappeared. It's the painful uncertainty of not knowing a loved one's fate, the anguish and guilt if they give up hope and finally let go. It can feel like an abandonment. You don't want to imagine your child or parent or cousin being tortured in some dark and lonely prison cell, but you also can't let go of the possibility that they might still be alive and could somehow find their way home. So people hold on in a perpetual state of hope, even as they know somewhere just below consciousness that they're holding on to an illusion. As a result, they never really grieve. Healing gets put on hold indefinitely. A body would provide closure, however painful it might be. Whatever signs of violence it might bear, a corpse would end the uncertainty and help people move on with their lives. But it doesn't happen that way with disappearances. That's their particularly cruel legacy. You don't get to know. Martin had heard stories like this before, hundreds of them. He lived through the worst years of the war, never left the country like a lot of his peers did. He just kept his head down at the university where he was finishing his degree and hoped he wouldn't get targeted by the army like so many of his classmates and professors. He knew the stories, but for whatever reason, Maria's experience, the way she still cleaned her son's room in anticipation of his possible return, really got to him. "He's never coming back, you know," Martin said. "Right, I know, he's not. There's no way." "And she can't see that," he continued. "Can't allow herself to see that." He shook his head as if trying to clear the story from his mind, and poured himself some coffee and sat down at his desk. Morning in Guatemala.
And all along we wish there were a happy ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are not always happy endings. Yeah. There are. I mean, I tried to include stories in the book where there are happy endings, because there really are stories where people heal and they recover and they build new lives. But, you know, it's a book of true stories, and if you're going to write true war stories, you're also going to write about some unhappy endings.
That's right.
It's so hard for me to imagine or to understand why there's so many people in the world who are willing to inflict the suffering on others.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, I think one of the occupational hazards doing this work is I feel a little like a split personality, because part of me is so cynical about what human beings are capable of doing to one another, the level of evil. No animal species other than humans engages in the kind of ritual torture and genocide that you see among humans. On the other hand, the other half of me, what I see is just the most extraordinary courage and light. I don't know how I've met what I call people of light everywhere I work. These are, you know, an Iraqi lawyer I met in Iraq. He's based in Baghdad. And here's a guy who could get out of the country. He could take his family. They've got the resources to leave, but he won't. And what he does, he spends his days defending people who are imprisoned on trumped-up charges and then tortured into confessing their guilt. And he defends them. You know, he doesn't have a great success rate because the system is so corrupt. And he gets death threats. And we were having lunch in Iraq a couple of years ago, and I said, why don't you pack up and leave? You know, you can get out of here. And he said, you know, he laughed, and he said, this is my home. How can I leave? And he went on to explain that for him, he had this passionate dream of making the country a decent, better place, and also this realization that there weren't many people willing to do the work he was doing. And if he stopped, then who was going to represent these people in court? And I've met people like that everywhere I've worked. And then I feel so inspired and blessed, really, just by knowing them, that it sort of counters the darkness.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Kenneth E. Miller, author of War Torn, Stories of Courage, Love, and Resilience. And, you know, one of the things that the book is trying to make clear is that there seems to be a narrow focus on PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, among survivors of armed conflict. And in your experience and your research, that focus is too narrow. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, one of the things, you know, PTSD was born as a diagnosis in 1980 by the American Psychiatric Association. It was created to capture the kind of post-war reaction that they saw in a lot of American soldiers who'd come back from Vietnam. And it very quickly became an international sensation. I mean, I don't mean to say it's not real, but it is real, PTSD. And in other cultures, trauma takes on somewhat different forms, but you do find trauma everywhere. But somehow, a lot of psychiatrists, psychologists from the West, or who got trained in the West, got so excited about this diagnosis that we went into war zones and refugee camps, really assuming that that was what we should be assessing. That trauma reactions everywhere would look like PTSD, so we should assess it and treat it, and also that it was the most pressing thing affecting people. And it's only in the last several years that we've begun to really see that that's not exactly right. So, for example, in this village in Sri Lanka where I worked and where we made the documentary film, Unholy Ground, about the survivors of this massacre, you know, you could find symptoms of trauma years later, but what was most profoundly affecting people was not PTSD. It was this deep grief for all that they'd lost, the people that they'd lost, the families, the dreams. There's a Sinhalese expression, castles in the air, and it means dreams of things that you won't get to do. This one man had lost his wife and his kids and his grandchild, and he left the home. He still, even after the village became safe and you didn't have to leave at night, he kept leaving because the loneliness of being in his house alone was so overwhelming. He needed to go and stay with relatives farther away. So, I think trauma is real, and in the Bosnian chapter in particular, I take you inside the treatment of some pretty severe PTSD. But it's really important for us to understand that people struggle with isolation and loneliness and despair and all kinds of other sources of distress or types of distress other than this narrow construct. The other thing that I say about PTSD in the book, and I try and do this through stories, is that when we see refugees, for example, with PTSD, and you see it a fair amount, only a minority of refugees actually develop enduring PTSD, but it is a real minority, we always assume it's because of whatever war they've lived through. But what research has shown, and some of my own studies as well, is that actually the PTSD may have its roots in experiences that people have had after getting out of their country. And I'll give you an example. This is from the Bosnian chapter. We were treating a woman who had pretty severe post-traumatic stress disorder. So, you know, you saw the flashbacks and the nightmares and the inability to relax, ever to relax. She would also have been severely depressed. She couldn't sleep. She kept having horrible images of violence, and she wasn't getting any better with therapy. She wasn't getting any better with medication. Almost a year into treatment, she looked pretty bad. And one day, we get a call from the local hospital that she's tried to kill herself. Could we come over? So we race over to the hospital, and I'm with, you know, one of the interpreters. And as we're driving over, I ask what's going. You know, I was not the clinician on this case. I came into the case rather late. One of our Bosnian clinicians was the therapist, and I asked for a little background. And there had been some hint that there might be violence going on in the family. This is a woman who had come over with her husband and young son, and they had escaped, you know, from a horrific massacre in their village. So they had all the history to make us think that her trauma and depression were about what she lived through. Yeah. Well, we get to the hospital, and I just asked her directly. I said, "Are you experiencing any violence at home?" And she looked up, startled, because all we'd really talked about in the previous year was the war. We kept trying to treat this war trauma. Well, she opened up about how during the last 2 years of refuge in Chicago, every day in their studio apartment, her husband had been sexually assaulting her in front of their child, and had threatened to kill them both if she told anyone or tried to escape. Well, you know, there we were, assuming that her PTSD was the result of the war, and it may partly have been, but the real war that she was struggling with was in Chicago, in her home. And so, of course, we immediately took action to get her and the child to safety. And for me, it was an extraordinarily powerful experience, and one I've never forgotten, because I realized I was so focused on what seemed obvious, the violence of the war, that I'd missed how stressful her day-to-day environment was there in Chicago. Now, granted, that's an extreme story, but we've learned that family violence, for example, goes up in refugee communities because of all the stresses they encounter. We've learned that when you put refugees or asylum seekers in detention centers, depression shoots up, suicide goes way up, that discrimination that refugees experience is one of the biggest predictors of how depressed they'll become. So we've learned that a narrow focus on treating war trauma often leads us to miss other things that are going on in people's lives.
You're listening to Writer's Voices. Our guest today is Kenneth E. Miller, author of War Torn, Stories of Courage, Love, and Resilience About Civilians in War-Torn Countries. Kenneth, is there another section of the book you'd like to share with us?
Sure. I'll take you to Sri Lanka. It's okay. One of my favorite places in the world. It's the most beautiful, actually, next to Guatemala, it's the most beautiful country. Mountains and ocean and just gorgeous scenery, but also the site of some horrible natural disasters, a big tsunami that hit in 2004, and a civil war that was absolutely brutal that just ended in 2009.
And where exactly is Sri Lanka?
Go ahead.
Where exactly is Sri Lanka for those of us who aren't?
Sri Lanka? Yeah. Sri Lanka is a small little island country about 20 miles south of India.
Okay.
There's this little strait of water that separates the two. It's a kind of a diamond-shaped island. And it's 70% Sinhala, and that's the ethnic group and that's their language, and they're Buddhist. And then there's minority groups of Tamils, and who speak another language, Tamil, and Muslims. And the war was primarily between the Buddhist government, the Sinhala government, and the Tamil Tigers, this extremely violent Tamil armed group fighting for independence. So I'm going to jump into the middle of this story, which is called The Sound of Waves. I had just come back from touring this area that had been devastated by the tsunami. I'd rented a motorcycle and just been riding up and down the road looking at the remnants of houses and villages that had been devastated by the water. And so I'll jump in here. Back at the hotel, I parked the motorbike and wandered down to the internet cafe across the way. A young man with a friendly smile waved me over. We'd seen each other in the cafe before, but never spoken. He introduced himself as Sunpath and invited me to sit and share a glass or two of lemon gin. He was a sweet guy, a photographer, couldn't have been more than 30 years old. He told me he was Sinhalese and had married a Tamil woman. That shouldn't matter, but in his view, it ended up getting her killed and turning him into a widower. Sunpath said he and his wife were expecting a child some years ago, and during her last month of pregnancy, she traveled north to see her parents in the Tamil city of Jaffna. He said the Tamil Tigers decided to send a warning message about Tamils marrying Sinhalese, so they tied his wife to a signpost and cut open her belly, killing both her and the unborn child. He described this graphically, motioning with his hands to make sure I understood the gruesome nature of the murder. As he spoke, he looked into my eyes with an unsettling intensity to be sure I was listening. Then he gazed into the distance behind me, as if pulled into the terrible imagery he just described. I found myself feeling thankful for the numbing effect the gin was having on my brain. I didn't want to picture the scene he'd painted, and the gin kept things blurry. Sampath continued with his story. He said he still woke up every night from nightmares about the child he never had the chance to see, his only memory an image of his butchered wife and the fetus she carried. The images won't stop, he said. It didn't matter whether he was awake or asleep. It had been 12 years, and the gruesome pictures just wouldn't go away. I uttered some words of empathy, but he talked right past them, didn't even seem to hear me. After the killing, he hit bottom. He wandered up to Goa, a former Portuguese colony that's become a hippie and techno scene on the northwest coast of India. There, he became addicted to anything that would numb the pain and dull the memories. He eventually found his way into a rehab center back in Sri Lanka, in the beautiful mountain city of Kandy. It was in Kandy that he met one of Golda Meir's grandsons. She was Prime Minister of Israel, who invited him to come to Israel and spend some time on a kibbutz. It sounded appealing, a chance to connect with the land and with himself as well. In Israel, Sampath got his life together and came back to Sri Lanka and started a photography business. He was really taking off, he said, business was good, and he was feeling hopeful about the future for the first time in years. One night in December 2004, he was shooting a wedding at the lighthouse coast, just off the Gaul Road. It was late when he was finally able to head home, so he left his gear in the hotel rather than carry it with him on his motorcycle. The tsunami hit that night, and the water destroyed everything, all of his equipment. Sisyphus in the boulder, a life rebuilt, taken down again by a series of massive waves. We sat in silence for a few moments, listening to the sound of the waves breaking against the beach. He smiled in a genuine way that caught me by surprise. Who could smile after what he'd been through, the story he just told? But he said, "You have to keep smiling and see the glass as half full. It's the only way to survive." He'd gotten a new camera and had landed several gigs already. "You've got to stay positive," he said. "It's just those dreams. If I could stop those horrible images from entering my dreams, I'd be okay." Lying in bed later that night, I listened to the waves outside my window. The sounds of the sea have always been calming to me, a primal response to the rhythm of water. But this night, the ocean made me uneasy, its destructive power barely hidden beneath the gentle sound of the waves. I couldn't stop thinking about the evening's conversation, about the cruelty and terrible losses my friend in the cafe had endured. I'm not exactly sure how we come to terms with the effects of evil on our lives. A natural disaster isn't malicious. A tsunami doesn't intentionally cause harm. It simply happens, indifferent to the destruction it creates and the despair it leaves in its wake. But to experience the death of a loved one killed with absolute intentionality, to be left with images of brutality and suffering, I wonder at times whether there can only be an imperfect healing, a coming to terms that leaves a thin scar over wounds that will always be tender. And yet, so many survivors of traumatic violence do seem to find ways of seeing the glass of life as half full. I continue to marvel at this will to not just survive, but to really live, to build anew, to regain one's faith in the better side of human nature. I've seen it everywhere my work has taken me. It's inspirational, like watching a flower grow out of concrete or break through the surface of snow. At times, it feels like witnessing something quietly profound, a kind of inner grace that springs from somewhere just beyond my comprehension.
Thank you. That was Kenneth Miller reading from War-Torn, Stories of Courage, Love, and Resilience. Kenneth, you've mentioned that you made a documentary film in Sri Lanka. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, you know, I was in Sri Lanka with a colleague of mine, Gayatri Fernando, a psychologist. She's Sri Lankan, but she teaches in L.A., and I was at Pomona College just outside of L.A. So Gayatri had invited me to come collaborate with her on a project, and my part of the project was we got a bunch of cameras, and we wanted to understand sort of the experience of childhood and the needs of kids living in these frontline villages in the east of the country where the war was happening. And so I went out to one of the villages with the staff of a local nonprofit who was doing psychosocial and mental health work there. And we gave the kids cameras in this one village and just invited them to photograph their worlds and come tell us stories about the pictures they took. And then they could choose a picture, and we had a printer, and we gave them the printer. And anyway, in this one village, the kids all came back. You know, some of the pictures were what you would expect. You know, a dog, my mom, my best friend, my teacher. But all the kids came back with pictures of a mass grave.
Wow.
And I was startled and stunned by this, and I didn't understand it. And I asked the counselors to explain this to me, and it turned out that 7 years earlier, in response, I think, to an Air Force attack on a Tamil village, Tamil tigers had crossed the rice paddies that separated, that became the de facto front line. They separated the two sides of the war. And they'd entered this village, and they'd killed 54 people, including 12 children, in this village. And this is the village where, for the better part of the past 7 years, people have been leaving at night, staying either in the jungle or with family and friends farther away, and then coming back and hunting, you know, continue with their lives during the day. And I think what, I mean, I felt utterly useless as a psychologist. I had no idea what I could offer. And the only thing I could think of, and it was probably naive, but I thought, I want to document, there's something remarkable here, not just the horror of what they've been through, but the parents' insistence on somehow giving these kids a normal childhood in the midst of this insanity. The fact that every morning before sunrise, they would get the kids back home to bathe them, get them in their school uniforms, and get them into class. And I thought that was just extraordinary.
Wow.
You know, what did I know about making films? But I
you learned fast.
I hired a Sri Lankan film crew. I flew back to the States. I wrote a bunch of grants. I got some money. Flew back, and we made a film about this village and the survivors of the massacre and the ways in which they put their lives together as best they could in the wake of this ongoing civil war and the violence that they lived through. And it's called Unholy Ground. And I decided to make it available. We showed it at some film festivals, but it's on YouTube and it's on Vimeo, which is like YouTube. It's free to see.
Unholy,
it's called Unholy Ground.
Unholy Ground. I'll look for that.
Mm-hmm.
We only have a minute left. Just real quickly, what can people do to help?
Well, you know, there's at the end of the book, there's a whole section on things you can do to help. And you can also access some of that if you go to my website. My website is Kenneth E. Miller. There's an E in the middle, okay. .com. And from there, you can also link to my Psychology Today blog. I write a blog on Psychology Today called The Refugee Experience. And I also talk there about some things people can do. But one of the most important things we can do is recognize that, you know, refugees are folks like us who are caught up in wars not of their doing. And refugees are not coming to the U.S. or elsewhere to steal jobs and take advantage of our resources. Refugees are not people. They're not economic migrants. They're not people looking for a better life. They're people who've had to leave everything behind because they had to save their lives.
Wow.
And we're a country built on immigrants and refugees. That's who we are.
That's right.
Our identity is. And, you know, we can maintain that identity, maintain our open hearts, and not let fear conquer compassion. I think that's one of the most powerful things we can do.
That's very, very powerful words. Unfortunately, we're out of time today. This book is a wonderful book, War Torn.
It is.
And by Kenneth E. Miller. And Mom, do you have a closing quote for us today?
I do, and I think this applies to our author today. Kindness can build on itself as well as violence can.
Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile, and see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.